the minds. But then there are the Greys who were born a special breed of wicked and clever, and have been trained all their lives to haunt the gold enemies of their gold masters. Like these, in the shuttle with us. They call them lurchers, after the mutt-dogs of Earth cross-bred for uncommon stealth, cunning and speed, all for one purpose, killing things bigger than they are.
"We're bound for Lost City, and it's just the 12 of you," I ask.
I know they're enough, I just don't like Greys, so I push their buttons. They eye me with the quiet reserve of a family meeting a stranger on the road. Valentin's the father. He's built like a squat block of dirty ice carved by a rusted blade, and his sun-blasted face is dark and set with quick eyes. His lieutenant, Soon Hua, leans toward us, tough and gnarled as an olive tree. Both are earthborn by the looks of their continentally ethnic features. These Greys wear no triangular badge of the Society's Legion on their civilian street clothes, means they've served their mandatory 20 years.
"We're tasked with your protection, Dominus," says Valentin, as Soon Hua loads an exotic circular weapon on the inside of her left wrist.
Looks plasma-based.
"My team has prepared a secure route. Estimated travel time, 24 minutes.
If Pliny finds out where I'm going, or if the Bologna know, I'm out of the Citadel."
"The lurchers know the situation," Victor says.
"I don't see a gold badge.
Mercenaries. Means we are good enough to live this long, Dominus," Valentin says flatly. "We've prepared for all eventualities. Contingency plans and support have been organized."
"How much support?"
"Enough. We're just the transporters, Dominus."
His mouth twitches into a smile, and I take his word for it.
"Bigger problem than the Bologna is third parties thinking an opportunity's just stumble their way. Where we're going, there will be a hell of a lot of third parties, Dominus. Shit complicates our ROI.
Soon what?
Wear this."
Sunwa tosses me a bag of plain clothing. Her voice drones on in a monotone drawl.
"You're tall, can't do shit all about that, but we'll do a quick dye job with this, this, and this."
She tosses Victor another bag.
"For you. Boss thought you'd dress too fancy."
Victor laughs at that.
"Muzzles off, boys!"
Valentin barks as the ship trembles and rises in the air.
"We're live!"
Thumpers and burners prime in practiced hands. Staccato sound of steel on steel, like metal knuckles cracking as magnetic rounds go into chambers. The lurchers conceal weapons in hidden holsters over tight scarab skin armor. Three wear illegal wrist weapons. I eye the contraband as I slip into my scarab skin. It drinks in the light, a strange pupil-like black. More the absence of color than anything else. Better than the Duro armor we had at the Institute. It'll stop some blades and the occasional projectile weapon like the common Scorcher. The ship shudders as its main engines overtake the vertical thrusters.
"Talon and Minotaur, be advised. Icarus is on the move,"
Valentin rasps into his comm.
"Repeat, Icarus is on the move."
Chapter 7. The Afterbirth. On Luna, there is no dark. No true dark, at least. Lights of a million shades swim together, glossing over the moon's jagged, cracking steel skin of cityscape. Snaking public trams and air thoroughfares, flashing communication centers, bustling restaurants, and austere police stations weave into the metal dermis of the city like blood capillaries, nerve endings, sweat glands and hair follicles. We fall away from gold districts, forsaking the high reaches of the city, where stately shuttles and grav boots ferry golds to opera houses atop kilometers-high towers.
We dived down past the wealthy silver and copper districts, wending our way through wrong paths and aerial trains, through the mid-districts where the yellows, greens, blues and violets reside, past the low district where greys and oranges make their homes. Down and down we go to the gutters of the city, where the roots of this colossal steel jungle burrow into the ground. Myriad low-colours ride public transportation from factories to their windowless apartments, some no larger than 1 meter by 3. Only room enough for a bed. Cars rattle out exhaust in clogged beacon-lit boulevards. The deeper we go, the fewer the lights, the dirtier the buildings, the stranger the animals, but the more brilliant the graffiti. I glimpse grey police standing over arrested brown vandals who covered an apartment complex with the image of a hanging girl. My wife. 10 stories tall, hair burning, rendered in digital paint. My chest constricts as we pass, cracking the walls I've built around her memory. I've seen her hanged 1,000 times now, as her martyrdom spreads across the worlds, city by city. Yet each time it strikes me like a physical blow, nerve endings shivering in my chest, heart beating fast, neck tight just under the jaw. How cruel a life, that the sight of my dead wife means hope. No matter our reputations, no enemy would seek us here. No ears to listen, no eyes to see. This is a place of gang killings, robberies, turf battles, drug trade. That my new friend wants such human privacy, privacy not even a jam field can really offer in the Citadel and the High City, means much. It worries me. Means the rules are void. But Victor was right, and Roque was not. Patience will do me nothing. I must take a risk. The team of lurchers has secured an abandoned garage. They provide security for the shuttle while Valentin's team escorts me from the garage into the bustle of the dirty street outside. Refuse and water make bogs out of alleys. Humid air is thick with the sweet musk of rot and the charred soot of burning garbage. Hawkers cry out wares from cracked sidewalks, clogged with reds, browns, greys and oranges of all species. Urchin, invalid, working class, gangers, tweakers, mothers, fathers, beggars, cripples, children. The lost. Io would say this is the hell they've built their heaven upon. And she'd be right. Gazing up, I see more than 0.5 kilometer of tenement buildings before the polluted haze makes a ceiling for the human jungle. Clotheslines and electrical lines crisscross overhead like vines. This sight is hopeless. What is there to change here but everything? We're to meet at the Lost Wee Den. It's a large, tall tavern with a flickering red sign covered in pithy graffiti. 15 levels, all open and looking down on a central drinking hall of tables and booths filled with some 200 customers. I can smell the piss in the metal booths, which sag from use. Bottles rattle and glasses clink as swill is slammed back. Indigo and pink lights flicker on the 15th floor, where they've dancers and private rooms for customers. I pass with Valentin through 2 bouncers with biomod hands. One obsidian with skin pale as bleached marble and arms thicker than mine. The other a dark-skinned grey with a scorcher muzzle built into his arm. The rest of my greys filter in behind me in staggered intervals, some wearing contacts, pretending to be other colours. One even wearing a flesh mask to look pretty as a pink. Can't even tell it's digital till you put a magnet near it. They look like they belong here. I doubt I do, despite the obsidian dye job they've done to me. The sigils on my hands are covered with obsidian prosthetics.
My hair is white, eyes black, skin made paler with cosmetics. Victor and I are too large to pass for any other colour. Fortunately, obsidians, though rarer than the other low colours, are not out of place down here. I follow Valentin to a table in an alcove near the back of the hall, where a young man lounges behind a pack of mercenaries and a single obsidian. A deep silence fills me as I watch the obsidian stand and leave the table to sit at an adjacent one. Others eye him too before remembering themselves and looking down at their drinks, like waterbirds as a crocodile glides past. The obsidian is a foot taller than I, and the whole of his face is tattooed with a skull. Stained. So much for a low profile. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven? I ask the reclining man.
Reaper! Even Milton knew Lucifer was a petty son of a bitch.
He smiles enigmatically and waves to the chair across from him.
Do stop towering over me.
He's not even wearing a disguise. I look over at Victor.
Thought it was going to be a new friend.
Well, you two have never been friends before. That'd be the new part. You boys have fun now.
You're not staying, I ask.
I showed you the door. You have to walk through it.
She squeezes my butt playfully and sways out.
The jackal watches her leave, leaning slightly to get a better view.
Didn't think you cared about women.
I could be dead and I'd still appreciate her. But I don't have to tell you that. Alone in space for months on end, ship all to yourself. Whatever was there to do.
I sit across from him. He offers me a bottle of greenish liquor. I shake my head.
I drink to forget about men like you.
Ha! An Arcosian insult, if I'm not mistaken. One of Lorne's best, though there's enough to choose from.
He leans back, enigmatic in his dullness. Face plain, eyes like smooth, worn coins.
Hair the color of desert sand.
Lone hand twirling a silver stylus with the quickness of an insect skittering over blasted ground, crack to crack.
The Jackal of Augustus and the Reaper of Mars, together again at long last. How we have fallen.
You chose the venue, I say, as he sets his stylus behind his ear and takes a chicken leg from a platter on the table.
He strips the skin with his teeth.
Does it unnerve you?
Why would it? We both know how fond you are of the dark.
He suddenly laughs, a whining, high-pitched bark like a dog being stabbed.
So much pride to you, Darrow, our Andromedus. Family all dead, disgraced, penniless things. So average that your parents didn't even try to introduce you to society. No friends remaining. No one who knew you before you slipped into the Institute, so unassuming-like. But how you rose when given a chance.
Well, at least you still like to talk, I mutter.
And you still like to make enemies.
Everyone has a hobby.
I examine the stump where his right hand should be.
Desperate for attention? You're the only gold alive that wouldn't bother getting a new hand.
I wonder why you provoke me still when your reputation is shattered, your bank accounts emptied.
I shift in my seat.
Oh, yes. You didn't know.
Plinius Thorough when he cuts a man's hamstrings.
He emptied all your funds. So, really, there's very little to you. But here you sit, at the bottom of a moon, alone,
with me, with mine. Throwing insults.
These are yours, I ask, glancing at the low colours around us.
I would have thought they'd disgust you.
Who said you have to like your children?
The jackal asks pleasantly.
They are a product of our golden loins.
He gnaws on the chicken leg, cracking the bone with his teeth before discarding it.
Do you know what I've been doing with my time?
Wanking off in the bushes.
Alas, no. My defeat at your hand set me back. I'm not afraid to say it.
You hurt me, and my plans. My sister also wounded me.
Gagging me? Binding me naked and throwing me at your feet? That stung.
Especially when all the grand lords and ladies of our fine, peerless caste got a chuckle at my expense. We both know you don't feel pain, Adrius.
Oh, call me the jackal. Hearing Adrius from your lips is like hearing a cat bark.
He shivers, but leans delightedly forward in his seat when a brown woman with thick arms and tattoos, webbing her pale, pockmarked skin, slips from the kitchens carrying three steaming bowls. She sets them before us.
Thank you,
he says, taking two for himself.
I eye the bowl suspiciously. I'm not a poisoner, he says. I could poison my father any time I want, but I don't. Do you know why?
Because you've not gotten what you need out of him.
And that is?
His approval.
The jackal watches me through the steam of his bowl.
Quite.
I've been offered a great deal of apprenticeships. They offer it to my father's name, not to me. They despise me because I ate students. But it's such hypocrisy. What else was I to do? We're told to win, and I did my best, and then they criticize, act noble as though they didn't commit murder themselves.
Madness.
He shakes his head with a little sigh. Yes, I could have gone to study war at the academy like you. I could have studied politics at the Politico School on Luna. I might have been a decent judiciar if I could stomach Venus.
But I will rise without their hypocrisy, without their schools. I've heard the rumors. Any true?
Most. He pulls more noodles out of the bowl, spreading red pepper sauce over them. I'm a businessman now, Darrow. I buy things. I own things. I create. Of course, I'm seen as a money-grubbing silver by those pretentious, peerless jackasses, but I am not one of the fading lords of 20th-century Europe. I understand there is power in being practical, in owning things, people, ideas, infrastructure. So much more important than money. So much more insidious than... He makes a funny motion with his hand. Spaceships and razors. Tell me, does a ship matter if you can't supply and transport the food to feed its crew? I, above all others, know the importance of food.
You own this place, don't you? I ask.
In a manner. He smiles with too much teeth. I feel I must be blunt with you. We were nearly 18 when we left the Institute. We are now 20. I have been 2 years in exile, and now I wish to return home.
To socialize with peerless jackasses.
I laugh. If you have been paying attention at all, you'll know I don't have your father's ear.
Paying attention? He shares a glance with Victra and leans forward.
Reaper, I am the attention. Do you know how much of the communications industry I've acquired?
No.
Good. That means I'm doing it properly. I've acquired more than 20%. With my silent partner, I own nearly 30.
You're wondering why.
Certain families like Victor's do not consider themselves dirtied by business. After all, the Julii have partaken in trade for centuries. But media is different for us. Slimy.
Leave that to Quicksilver and his ilk.
So why would someone with my lineage dirty his hands with it? Well, I want you to imagine media as a pipeline to a city in the desert.
he waves around, our metaphorical desert. I can provide only 30% of the content of what comes through that pipeline, but I can affect 100% of it. My water contaminates the rest. That is the nature of media. Do I want this city in the desert to hallucinate? Do I want its inhabitants to writhe in pain? Do I want them to rise up? He sets his chopsticks down. It all starts with what I want. And what do you want? I ask. Your head, he says. Our eyes meet like two iron rods colliding, sending stinging reverberations through the body. A palpable discomfort even being near him, much less meeting those dead gold orbs. He's so young, my age, but there's a childishness to him, a curiosity despite the ancient cast of his eyes, that makes him feel like a perversity. It's not that I feel cruelty and evil radiating from him, it's the feeling that crept over me when Mustang told me how, as a boy, he killed a baby lion because he wanted to see its insides to understand how it worked. You have a weird sense of humor. I know. Well, I'm so glad you get my jokes. So many prickly peerless these days. Duels, honor, blood. All because they're bored. There's no one left to fight. So gory damn tedious. I believe you are making a point.
Ah, yes.
The jackal runs his hand through his slicked back hair, like I've seen his father do. I brought you here because Pliny is an enemy of mine. He's made my life very difficult. Even penetrated my harem. Do you know how many spies of his I've had to kill? I went through so many servants. I'm not trying to make you feel sorry for me, he says quickly. I was on the verge of it. Understanding my plight, however, is how you will help me best. As of now, Pliny controls my father's favor, like a snake hissing in his ear. Leto is his design. Did you know that? I didn't. He found the darling boy, knew he would win my father's cold heart because he would remind father of my dead brother Claudius. So Pliny cultivated him, trained him, and convinced my father to adopt him as a ward, with aims of making him the heir. Then you come waltzing into our lives and disrupt Pliny's plan. It took 2 years to dispatch you, but patiently he did. Just as he did me. Now Leto will be my father's heir, and Pliny will be Leto's master. That hits me hard. I knew Pliny was dangerous. Perhaps I never really knew just how dangerous. So what's your plan? I glance around the room. Going to take back your father's favor with plebeians and pitchforks? As any gold with a decent education would know, there's a certain crime syndicate that runs things in Lost City. A vast criminal enterprise that, if you trace it all the way to the tip-top, is under the influence of the office of the sovereign of our little society. Octavia Auloon may seem the paragon of gold virtue, but she's got a fetish for the dirty stuff. Assassinations, organizing workers' strikes in her own arch-governor's domains, rigging appointments. Her handling of Lost City is no different. She and her furies hand-picked the crime family leadership. These three individuals are her creatures. But here's the juicy kink. I've found certain members of that same organization who are restless. I frown. They don't like Loon. She's an onerous bitch. One who has spat in my father's eye and cozied up to the Bologna, but no. My champions don't think on that plane. They are low colours, Darrow. They're restless to be atop the shit pile. Why Lost City? I ask. What does it matter?
It is merely a piece of the puzzle. I'm going to help these ambitious low colors move up for a price. When they are in power, they are going to kill off a menace that plagues the society. Ares and his sons.
Chapter 8. Scepter and Sword. I go cold inside. The sons of Ares? I wasn't aware they were so dire a threat.
They're not yet, but they will be, he says. The Sovereign knows it. So does my father, even if it is not in vogue to say it aloud. The Society has faced terrorist cells before. Throw enough lurcher teams at them and they are dispatched easily enough. But the sons are different. They are not a rat biting our heels, but a termite colony slowly gnawing our foundation as quietly as possible till they've done such work that our house crumbles around us. My father has given Pliny the task of eliminating the sons, but Pliny has been failing. He will continue to fail because the sons of Ares are clever, and because my media adores giving them attention. But when they become a thing so dreadful to society, to the Sovereign, to my father, that the very machine of governance grinds to a halt, I will step forward and say, I will cure this disease in 3 weeks. And then I will, with my media, with the syndicate systematically killing all the sons, and with you gloriously beheading Ares himself. You want a figurehead. I am not glamorous. I do not inspire. You are like one of the old conquerors, charismatic and virtuous. When they look at you, they see none of the soft decadence of our meager time, none of the political poison that has saturated Luna since Loon's family rose to power. They will look at you and see a cleansing knife, a new dawn for a second golden age. Like father, like son, both targeting the sons of Ares in similar ways. It's chilling, thinking of the war that will rage between crime syndicate throat-cutters and Ares agents. It'll destroy the sons.
The sons of Ares are only the beginning. A leverage point. You want to rule.
What other ambition is there?
But not just Mars.
Just because I'm small doesn't mean my dreams have to be. I want it all. And to get it, I'm willing to do anything. Even share.
Perhaps you're not aware of what happened 2 months ago. I say, stop a gold anywhere and ask. They'll tell you what the Bologna family did to the Reaper of Mars. I have no reputation. The only thing I inspire is laughter.
Cassius was shamed, the jackal says in irritation. He was pissed on, beaten at the Institute, embarrassed. Now he's the deadliest jeweler on Luna. He fought any that would contest his worth, and now he's the Sovereign's favorite new pet. Did you know the old crow is making him an Olympic knight? Lorne au Arcus and Venetia au Reine both retired this year. That means the posts of Rage Knight and Morning Knight are open.
She'd make him one of the 12.
He is a piece on her board.
The jackal leans forward.
But I tire of playing pawn to my elders.
As do I. Makes me feel like a pink, I say.
Then let us rise together. I the scepter, you the sword.
You won't share. It's not in your nature.
I do what I need to do, no more, no less. And I need a warlord. I'll be Odysseus, you be Achilles.
Achilles dies in the end.
Then learn from his mistakes.
It's a good idea.
I pause at his spreading smile.
With one problem. You are a sociopath, Atreus. You don't only do what you need to do. You wear whatever face you need, whatever emotion you desire like a glove. How could I ever trust you? You killed Pax. I let the words hang in the air. You killed my friend, your sister's protector. Pax and I had never met before. All I saw was an obstacle in my path. Of course, I knew of the Telemannuses, but after Claudius got his brains splattered everywhere, Father split Mustang and me up to protect us, put me in even greater isolation than her. I was his heir. I had no friends, only tutors. He ruined my youth. And then he discarded me as he discarded you, because we lost. You and I mirror each other. A fight breaks out on the level above us. A scorcher cracks. Bouncers rush upward, cradling their own weapons. Most of the patrons sit undisturbed. What of your sister? I ask hesitantly, knowing deep down that I have no other options left but this one.
Do you want to know how she fares? He asks plainly. Who shares her bed?
I can give you whatever answers you want. My eyes are everywhere. I don't want that. I shake my head, trying to banish the dark idea of someone sharing her bed, of her finding joy in someone else, even if she deserves to. Even stranger is thinking the Jackal knows these things. Is she involved in this?
No, the Jackal says with a heavy laugh. You know she's with Loon now. It's hilarious, really. Who would have thought that, of the two of us, she'd be the prodigal twin? Well, more prodigal.
She cannot be hurt, I say. If she is, I will cut off your head.
That's aggressive.
But you have a deal.
So, you're with me? I've been with you since I got into the shuttle. You know I have no other options. And I know no other person who would ever summon me here. The variables could only lead to this end.
And why should they not?
I took his hand. He took a friend. All he has done is bite and claw for his own survival. Watching him now, so small and plain in a world of gods, it's almost as if he's the hero, nobly struggling against a father who rejected him, against a society that laughs at his size, his weakness, and scorns him as a cannibal, even though it was they who told him to do whatever he had to do to win. In an odd way, he is like me. He could have had his hand repaired, but he chose not to, wearing it as a badge of honor instead of shame. So, I'll go along with this. Then in the end, maybe I'll kill him. For Pax. His face splits into a grand smile.
I'm so pleased, Dara. So pleased. And, to be honest, a bit relieved.
Well, what is next? I ask. You must need something from me now.
A gold by the name of Fensor Al Drusilla has learned of my dealings with the syndicates.
He is trying to blackmail me. I need you to kill him.
Of course.
When?
Not for a week or so. The real purpose of killing him will be to gain favor with one of the Sovereign's cousins who was slighted by Fensor. With Fensor's death, you'll fall into the cousin's favor.
I choked down a laugh. You'll have me play the role of a pixie gallant, flitting about court, bedding ladies.
Mustang will think I'm doing it to spite her.
The Jackal's eyes sparkle with mischief.
Who said anything about ladies?
Oh,
I say, realizing what he means. Oh, that's complicated. Tactus might be better for this. The Jackal chuckles at my surprise.
Oh, you'll do just fine.
But all this is worry for another day. For now, relax.
I'll purchase your contract through a second party as soon as it goes up for auction.
The Bologna will try to buy it.
I have a backer. We'll outspend them.
Victra?
No. She's more of a broker in this. What you have to understand about Victor is she's not, how do you say, partisan. She just loves stirring the pot.
The backer you'll meet soon enough. That won't work, I say. I want to meet him now. I'm not your puppet. I share everything I know. You share everything you know.
But I know so much more.
Fine. He leans forward. You'll meet him tonight. It's not that I don't trust you. I just think it appropriate that he introduces himself. Fine enough. I want to bring the Howlers back, and Severo.
Done. You'll also need to select a blade master, someone to tutor you with the razor. We'll need you to kill a few people publicly in the future.
I know how to use a razor, I say. Not what I've heard. Come now, there's no shame in it. I have a few names.
It's a pity Arcos isn't tutoring. These days I might actually have the funds to afford Stoneside and his Willow Way.
His words trail off, and his eyes drift from me, pulled to the slinking form of a woman who cuts through the smoke and drab of the tavern like an ember falling through fog. I can smell the almond on her skin, the citrus of her lips as she nears our table, graceful and stirring as the air of Venus's summer coast. Bones fragile, avian. She wears a black shift that covers her skin except her bare shoulders. Then I catch her eyes, and I almost fall out of my chair. It's a shot to the heart. My pulse patters. It's her. The girl with wings who could never fly. But now, she's fled from Mickey, it seems. Wings gone, ripened into womanhood. But why is Evie here? Did the sun send her? I can barely keep my composure. She hasn't recognized me. I didn't know roses to grow so deep among the weeds, the jackal says to her. Her laughter drifts like the beating of a butterfly's wings. She traces the bottom edge of the worn table and shrugs minutely.
Common men can't afford uncommon things, but my mistress heard uncommon men were in Lost City and sent me as an ambassador.
Ah! The jackal leans back, appraising her.
You're a syndicate girl. One of Verbanas?
Off her nod, the jackal looks at me and mistakes my expression of surprise for one of desire. Take her upstairs, Darrow. On me. A welcoming gift. Let me know if you want to buy her. We can discuss business tomorrow. At the word Darrow, Evie's composure buckles for a blink. She steps back and I hear her breath pattern change. And when her eyes meet mine, I know she sees through the obsidian disguise and glimpses the red underneath all these lies. However, the surprise there means she's not here for me. She's here for the jackal. But why? Is she with the sons, or did Mickey finally sell his prize to this Verbanna gangster?
I don't do slaves, Evie says to the jackal, pointing to my obsidian sigils.
You'll find there's more to this one than meets the eye.
Dominus, I...
He grabs her hand, twisting her pinky horribly. Shut up and do as you're told, girl, or we'll take what you won't give. He flashes a great smile and releases her. She holds her hand, trembling. It doesn't take much to wound a pink. I stand. I believe I'll take it from here, my friend.
I'm sure you will.
I wave the bodyguards away who try to accompany me. I follow Evie up the hand rungs leading to the fourth floor, earning hoots from some of the patrons. My eyes catch one of the holocans above the bar. Images of a bombing ripple in three dimensions. It looks to be at a cafe. A gold cafe. My eyes widen as the extent of the devastation is shown. Was it the sun's? Another bombing flashes across a different screen, and another till dozens of bombings flood the screens throughout the tavern. All heads turn to watch, silence yawning through the vast tavern. Evie's hand tightens around mine, and I know it was the sons who committed the bombings. They sent her. But why Luna? Why the jackal? Why haven't they contacted me? Hurry, she says, as we reach the 15th floor, pulling me through the pink lights, past the dancers and hungry patrons, to the last door at the end of a narrow corridor. I follow her inside the dark room and immediately smell the acrid tang of scorcher oil. Air shifts behind me as a man in a ghost cloak creeps forward. It takes considerable effort to resist the impulse to kill him.
He's one of ours, Evie snaps.
She turns on the light. Six reds in heavy military tech decloak. They wear demon helms with high-grade optics.
Call in the skimmer.
He's not Aegis, our Augustus,
one of them growls.
He's a bloody obsidian.
Strange-looking one. One of the reds with the optics jumps back, scorcher priming.
Bone density is gold.
Stop, Evie shouts. He's a friend. Harmony has been looking for him.
Not Ares or Dancer.
You weren't here for me, I say, eyeing their weapons. You were hunting.
She turns to me.
I'll explain later, but we have to go.
What did you do?
I ask, as one of the reds pulls out a plasma torch and cuts a hole in the wall, opening the room up to the stink of the city. Moist air rushes in, and lights flood the room as a small dropship descends, opening its side hatches parallel to the improvised door.
Dara, there's no time.
I grab her.
Evie, why are you here?
Her eyes flash with triumph.
Aegis, our Augustus, has murdered 15 of our brothers and sisters. I was sent to capture or kill him. I chose the latter. In 20 seconds he'll be ash.
I rip one of the red's datapads off his arm and prime my concealed grav boots. Evie shouts at me. The boots whine mournfully as they lift me into the air. I rip back the way we came, rupturing through the door instead of opening it. Flying down the hallway like a bat out of hell. I smash past a dancer, careen over two orange customers, and turn a razor-tight right angle down over the railing toward the jackal's table as he finishes his liquor. His stained marks me, as do the greys. Too slow. On the screens, over the bombings, the static crackles, and a blood-red helm burns.
Reap what you sow.
Ares' voice growls from a dozen speakers. The table melts under the jackal's hand, consumed by the bomb Evie planted. The stain throws the jackal away from the table like a doll and curls his titanic body around the mushrooming energy. His mouth moves in a death whisper.
Skirnir Alfalnir.
Chapter 9. The darkness. The energy blossoms outward from the stained liquid to the eye, evaporating his body and spreading over the floor like spilled mercury before darkening, slipping back to the origin, sucking men and chairs and bottles toward it like a black hole before detonating with a deep nightmare roar. I snag the jackal up by his jacket and fly through the wall, slamming shoulder first as, behind us, glass, wood, metal, eardrums, and men rupture. My boots fail. We fly across the street and slam into the building opposite, cracking concrete and falling to the ground as the lost wee den shrinks inward like a grape, becoming a raisin, becoming dust. She exhales a death rattle of fire and ash before sagging to ruin. Beneath me, the jackal's unconscious, his legs badly burned. I vomit as I try to stand, my skeleton creaking like the trunk of a young tree after its first hard winter wind. I stumble up only to fall back to the ground, emptying my stomach a second time. Pain in my skull. Nose dripping blood. Ears trickling with it. Eyeballs throbbing from the explosion. Shoulder dislocated. I gain my knees, wedge my shoulders against the wall, and roll the joint back in, quivering out breath as it pops into place. The feeling of needles tickles my fingers. I wipe the sick off my hands and wobble finally to my feet. I pick up the jackal and squint into the smoke. I hear nothing but the wailing of stereocilia, like screaming sparrows in my inner ear, throbbing. I shake away the lights that dance across my vision. Smoke swallows me. People flow past, water around a rock, rushing to help those trapped. They'll find only death, only ash. Sonic booms puncture the night. The jackal's support teams roar down from the city above, and as they land to take him out of this hell, the sparrows in my ears fade, devoured by the crackling of flames and the crying of the wounded. I stand in front of an abandoned factory, 400 kilometers from the citadel, deep in the old industrial sector. Newer factories have been built atop this one, burying it beneath a fresh skin of industry like a deep blackhead. Grime skins the place. Carnivorous moss. Rust-filled water. I'd have thought it a dead end if I didn't know my quarries so well. The datapad I took from the Red survived the explosion. I left the jackal for his support teams and slipped farther down the street, where I stole a grey police craft. After wiping the datapad's tracking device, I hacked into the datapad coordinates history. I knock hard on the locked door to the factory's main level. Nothing. They must be shitting themselves. So I kneel on the ground, hands behind my head, and wait. After a few minutes, the door creaks open. Darkness inside. Then several figures slip forward. They bind my hands, cover my head with a bag, and push me into the factory. After taking me down an old hydraulic elevator, they guide me steadily toward the sound of music. Brahms' Piano Concerto No. 2. Computers hum. Welding torches flare bright enough to glow through the bag's fabric.
"Here, get off him, you brutes!" snaps a familiar voice.
"Careful, clown!"
rumbles some Red.
"Babble at me all you want, you rusty baboon. He's worth more than 10,000 of you inbred rough..."
"Dallo, get out," Evie says softly. "Now."
Boots thud away.
"Can I stop pretending now?" I ask.
"By all means," Mickey says. I snap the cuffs they use to bind my wrists behind my back and strip off the bag that covers my head. The concrete and metal laboratory is clean, quiet but for the soothing music. A faint haze floats in the air from Mickey's water pipe in the corner. I tower over him and Evie. She can't contain herself. No longer the seductress Rose from the tavern, she throws herself into me like a little girl greeting a long-lost uncle. Her hands linger on my waist as she eventually pulls back and stares up into my gold eyes with her pink ones. Despite her giggling, she's all sensuality and beauty, with willowy arms and a slow, intimate smile that echoes none of the grief killing nearly 200 people should mark her with. The winged girl has become a carrion bird, and she doesn't seem to have noticed. I wonder if she'd smile so broadly if she had to kill all those people with a knife. How easy we make mass murder.
"I could recognize you anywhere," she says. "When I saw you at the table, my heart skipped a beat, especially in that ridiculous obsidian makeup."
"Darrow, what's wrong?"
She yelps when I pick her up by the front of her jacket and shove her against the wall.
"You just killed 200 people!"
I shake my head, sore and heavy with the weight of what's happened. "How could you, Evie?"
I shake her, seeing again the crew of my ship venting into space, seeing all the dead I've left in my path, feeling Julian's pulse fade to nothing.
"Darrow, darling,"
Mickey tries. "Shut up, Mickey."
"Yes, all right."
"Reds, pinks, low colours, your own people, like they were nothing." My hands tremble.
"I was following orders, Darrow," she says. "Aegis has been investigating us. He had to be taken out."
So, with all his scheming, he'd been noticed. Tears brim in Evie's eyes. I don't recoil from them. Who gives a shit about how she feels after what she's just done? But I release her, letting her slide pathetically down the wall, hoping she might show some glimmer of regret that would make me think those tears are for the people she killed, and not for herself, not because she's scared of me.
"This isn't how I wanted it to be," she says, wiping her eyes. "When you saw me again?"
I stare down at her, confused. "What happened to you?"
"She had a different teacher than you," Mickey says. "I took her wings off, and Harmony gave her claws."
I turn to Mickey. "What the hell is going on?"
"It would take a year to explain."
He crosses his arms and examines me. "But let us first say you've been missed, my darling prince. Second, please do not link my morality to that lost soul. I agree, Evie is a little monster."
He glares past me at Evie as she stands. "Maybe now you'll see yourself for what you are."
His sneer fades, quick eyes scanning me toe to head.
"Third, you look divine, my boy. Absolutely divine."
His eyes dance over my face. His mouth opens, closes, tripping over itself. It has so much to say. Sharp of face, oily of hair, he slides forward like a blade on ice, all angles, skin wrapped around slender bones. Was he so thin when last I saw him? Or does he simply not have his cosmetics? No, his blinks are slow, languid. He's tired, older, and seemingly beaten down. A queer air of vulnerability in the way his shoulders hunch and his eyes dart around, as if expecting to be hit at any moment.
"I asked you a question, Mickey," I say. "I can't think about the forest. I'm still examining the tree." "It's astounding how your body flourished. Simply astounding, my darling. You've actually grown larger. How fair are your pain receptors? Did the hair follicles ever grow irritated, as I was concerned? What about the muscle contraction? Do you find it above the average of your peers? Pupil dilation fast enough? All I heard for months was talk of you on the HC. They could not show the Institute, of course, but there were videos leaked on the HoloNet. Such videos! You killing a peerless scarred, taking some strange fortress in the sky like a champion of old."
Even they swallow the myths of the conquerors, the noble champions of old. He grips my shoulder desperately, his hand weaker than I remember.
"Tell me about your life. What the Academy is like. Tell me everything. Are you still lovers with that delectable Virginia Owl Augustus?"
He frowns suddenly.
"Oh, of course you're not. She's with..."
"Mickey!" I grip him. "Calm down." He laughs so hard he coughs, turning from me to wipe his eyes.
"Just good to see a friendly face. They don't allow me kind company these days. None at all. Monstrous, really."
"Shut up, Mickey!" Evie snaps. His eyes slip to Evie, who now stands far from my reach, fingering the burner holstered on her hip, as though it would protect her from me.
"Why are you on Luna? What is going on?" I ask. "Have you joined the Suns?"
"Much has happened,"
Mickey murmurs.
"I'm not here by..." "He works for us now, Darrow,"
Evie interrupts coldly.
"Whether he likes it or not,
We took his little skin den apart, used the funds he made from selling flesh to buy transport here and equip an army. We're striking back, Dara. Finally.
One pink terrorist and a handful of reds playing with guns, I say without looking at her. Is that your army?
We drew blood from the Goals today, Darrow. If you don't respect me, respect that. I killed the son of Mars's arch-governor. What have you done that makes you think you can come here and spit on what we've done?
You didn't kill him, I say.
She looks blankly at me. Don't be ridiculous.
I stare back, angry.
But how? The bomb, she says. You're lying.
I got him out in time.
Why?
Because my mission is complicated. I need him. Where is Dancer? Who is in charge here?
Mickey. I am, says another voice from my past. One with an accent like my wife's, except this voice is poisoned and bitter with anger.
I turn to see Harmony at the door, half her face still blasted with that terrible scar. The other half is cold and cruel, older than I remember. Harmony, I say mildly. The years have done nothing to warm us to each other. It's good to see you. I need to debrief. There's so much to say. I can't even think where to begin.
Then I notice the glance she gives Evie.
Harmony, where is Dancer?
Dancer is dead, Darrow.
Later, Harmony sits with me in front of Mickey's desk in an office of cheap, angular furniture and jars filled with hybrid organs floating in preservative gas. Mickey sits behind the desk, fidgeting with that old platonic puzzle cube of his.
He sees me looking at it and he winks.
He's gotten better. Evie leans against a barrel of chemicals. I sit, utterly lost.
Dancer had a plan for me. He had a plan for all this. He's not supposed to be dead. He can't be. It was Dancer's last wish for Mickey to carve us a new army, one that will rival the Goals in speed and strength. We've taken our greatest men and women and put them to the carving. They cannot survive a Gold procedure like the one you endured, but some managed to brave this new program.
She waves out the glass where 100 coffin-like tubes splay across the floor. Inside each, reds of a new breed. Soon we'll have 100 soldiers who can cut gold deeper than any before. As if 100 would be enough to fight the gold war machine. My howlers and I could likely shred any unit these terrorists put together. And we're not even the deadliest golds. She gestures with a new arm, having lost the one of flesh and bone to an obsidian when raiding an armory for weapons. It's a limb of metal now, fluid and strong, with illegal black market sockets for weaponry. Good workmanship, but nothing compared with Mickey's carving. Of course, she'd never let him work on her. So Mickey is a prisoner? I ask.
Slave, more like.
Mickey grunts with a small smile. They don't even give me wine.
Shut up, Mickey.
Evie snaps.
Evie?
Harmony fixes the young woman with a tolerant stare before regarding Mickey.
Remember what we talked about, eh? Mind your tongue.
Mickey flinches, eyes darting down to her left hand. There is an empty holster on her belt, something Mickey is scared of. Harmony is behaving for me. You're afraid he's going to say how you beat him? She shrugs, dismissing my judgment.
Mickey sold girls and boys. Can't enslave a slaver. Far as I see it, he's bloody damn lucky not to have a bullet in his brain. Could hire a carver to give him horns and wings and a tail so he'd look like the monster he is, but I haven't. Have I, Mickey?
No.
No.
No, Domina. The word makes me recoil.